5, 4, 3, 2. You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. For years, people have taken crack at the U.S. military, claiming that we don't need a large military, or that our troops are not well-trained, or the leadership of our military is not up to standard. I think by now there's been a renewed sense of pride in the U.S. Armed Forces, regardless of the branch, Army, Navy, Air Force. And this week my guest is Benjamin Runkle, who was a former American soldier and now author of the new book, Generals in the Making, How Marshall, Eisenhower, Patton, and their peers became the commanders who won World War II. And I will tell you up front, ladies and gentlemen, that the people we're talking about in this book, and Ben's done an excellent job of really showing a side of each of these great leaders, what they were like as they were coming up, the things that they had, the challenges that they had to become great leaders. And I guess the question in everybody's mind is, will we ever see this level of leadership again across our military? And we'll let Ben talk about that. Ben, nice to have you with us.
Good morning, Al. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. The book, I mean, I'm not a military guy. You are. So obviously you lived a lot of the things that you talk about in the book. But let me ask you first and foremost, because this is what I came away with after reading Generals in the Making, that perhaps from World War II to the end of World War, from the end of World War I through World War II, we probably saw the greatest grouping of military leaders in U.S. history. Is that a fair statement?
I think it is a fair statement. I think that this was something that was also recognized by both our allies and our adversaries. Winston Churchill said when he came and visited the United States in 1946 that it was just a mystery to him how such an incredibly small army that the United States had during the interwar army could produce such great generals, could produce such great staffs that were able to not just raise a big army, but to be able to move them effectively on the battlefield. Also, Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt, one of the senior German commanders, after he was captured, said the same thing, that we were totally taken by surprise by the level of your command, that in World War I, you had maybe one or two good commanders. But we found that in the Western Front, fighting against the Americans, that they had almost all of their corps commanders were very good. So I think it's a fair assessment to say that the U.S. Army's World War II commanders really did represent the greatest generation of generals that the U.S. produced.
I also came away with the idea that in spite of raising large armies as we did during World War II, I mean, you can go from, let's say, 20,000 men and women to 200,000. It doesn't matter the numbers if you don't have, and I think you point this out in the book, but I'm going to let you talk a little bit about that. Unless the commanders, and it may be no more than one or two generals in this case, as you mentioned, we had quite a few during World War II, but again, is it fair to say that in spite of massive armies, in spite of the newest and most potent technology and weaponry, without good leadership, it doesn't mean anything?
No, I think that's absolutely true. And this was during the debates in the Great Depression when Congress, out of just sheer economic necessity, had to make massive cuts to the Army's budget. Who was then Chief of Staff, Douglas MacArthur, fought a strident rearguard battle because he was saying, if you can cut the number of bases, you can cut the number of rifles, you can cut the number of tanks we're trying to build. But he was adamant, do not cut the officer corps. And this wasn't job protection for him. He was saying that when we rebuild all this stuff, we need somebody who knows how to use it. We need somebody who has a vision for what to do. And we need people with experience to train all the masses of the mass force that we're going to be producing. And he recognized that if you cut the officer force too low, you couldn't rebuild this experience. And it's ironic because then when MacArthur and Eisenhower went to build a Philippine army from scratch in the late 1930s, he completely forgot his own advice. When he made his cuts, he made his cuts to the Philippine officer corps and the Philippine who would train the masses of Filipinos that were going to produce his army. And it was a complete disaster. And I think you could say similarly in modern warfare, there have been multiple studies done that in the Arab-Israeli wars over the second half of the 20th century, the Arab armies were usually better equipped, had more modern equipment, more of it, more forces, but they were usually very badly led. And so I think that absolutely it's an important point that you still have to have, you know, this doesn't take anything away. You need to have valiant soldiers, and the sacrifices that our GIs made in World War II, you know, obviously deserve full recognition, but you still need leadership and strategy to be able to help them to fight to their maximum capability.
The other thing that stood out in my mind after reading Generals in the Making, and especially MacArthur, I know he was revered during World War II. A couple of things came to light. One, the guy was a quirky kind of person. You know what I'm talking about. Multiple facets to that personality, but also someone that was very strident, determined to get his way. So the question is, great leaders, military leaders, regardless of what branch of the armed forces that they choose, is that innate in them, or do you have to have that tenacious type of personality that he had?
I think it's both. I think that in some leaders, it's innate, that you're never going to take someone who has absolutely no capability whatsoever and by training and by experience turn them into a Patton and Eisenhower, Marshall, et cetera. But I think that also that even though some people have innate qualities, circumstances, or that they just isn't developed, it isn't honed. So I think it's a combination of the two.
Who in recent memory, I'm trying to think, as early as Middle East engagements, but going back even to Vietnam, I'm trying to think of a general that might have had that same kind of moxie, that kind of, look, I'm going to question from the top down, from the president, the Congress, the War Department, all the way down to even my supervisors. Has there been a leader since this period that you talk about in your book that had that same sense of bravado?
Well, I think there have definitely been a lot. I mean, I think Creighton Abrams in the second half of the Vietnam War was an excellent commander, an excellent leader. I think that, you know, as far as moxie and bravado, I think Schwarzkopf definitely fit that bill, although would add that he was notoriously somewhat abusive to his subordinates in a way that isn't accommodated well in the modern military. I mean, obviously, it was a brilliant campaign, but that's one thing that in the difference between World War II versus nowadays is that much more sensitive to, I don't want to say abuse, but just very harsh. I'm always hesitant a little bit to comment on the modern Iraq and Afghanistan wars because I know so many of the generals from having worked in the Defense Department on the House Armed Services Committee,
right,
and having served in Iraq, that I'm always afraid if I mention one or two that and I leave someone else out, that yeah, someone will be offended. But I think one example that people are familiar with the name, I think H.R. McMaster very much has the reputation of that sort of, when you hear him speak, you get that energy that he has. Every presentation, when I was on the House Armed Services Committee, he came and gave a presentation to us regarding corruption in Afghanistan, a very dry topic, important for the overall strategic effort, but a very dry topic. But again, approached it with the energy of Patton about to address his troops before going into the Tennessee maneuvers or the Louisiana maneuvers, that he could get that sort of energy. And so you could see when he led commands, both in before the Battle of 73 Easting in the Gulf War and, say, before the campaign to liberate or to secure Tal Afar during 2005 in Iraq, you could see where that same energy and imagine commanders of a previous generation. And again, by saying that, I'm not all the names of generals I know, I'm not excluding them, but I'm just trying to find one example.
Right, right. And that's understandable. But it sounds like, you know, the mold wasn't cast aside after World War II. We may not have that same, you know, they may not reach the pinnacle as many of the generals that you talk about or leaders in your book. But we still turn out men and women who inspire, men and women who lead, and people who can, you know, as I, in your book, and I'm again, never was a military guy, but I'm thinking, especially as you talked about MacArthur and his tenure at West Point, I'm thinking to be a 17 or a 18-year-old kid, knowing that you're being groomed for leading other men into battle, many of which will never come back, it takes a certain individual, first of all, to even want to go to that school or to choose that as a career, but more importantly, to be the leader, to inspire, to comfort, to guide. And so many times in the book, Ben, you got the sense that, well, you know, it was either my way or the highway. Again, I go back to MacArthur because of all the people in the book, he seemed to display that kind of attitude. If a leader doesn't have that ability, as you said, to walk in and inspire men to go to war, does that make the idea of putting a backpack and putting a rifle in your hands and going into harm's way more difficult?
Yes, but, and I'll flip this equation in a sense, that was definitely true of a MacArthur, that MacArthur, as you say, could be eccentric, could sometimes be problematic. But you see it repeatedly. Jacob Devers, when he takes over the artillery detachment at West Point while MacArthur is the superintendent, he gets about 5 minutes in the superintendent's office. And MacArthur just starts speaking with such energy, such verb, that Devers was sort of, you'd have done anything he'd have asked you. And even in MacArthur's darkest days during the pre-World War II period in the Philippines, where he was almost delusional about the Philippine Army's capability, about the strategic situation, officers would still come out and they'd say what he was saying made no sense, but man, I wanted to execute what his vision was. Even as they said, he just had no idea what the state of the Philippine Air Force was, the Philippine Navy, but he just filled the room with such an energy that made you want to achieve. Now, on the flip side, though, there were others. MacArthur did not take criticism well. MacArthur didn't brook any dissent whatsoever. A difference, though, I think that makes some of the great commanders, was that they had a real sense of humility about themselves. Take George Marshall. When he was assistant commandant of the infantry school, an incredibly important period for the interwar army, that of his students and his instructors that worked under him at the infantry school from 1927 to 1932, 200 of them rose to be generals during World War II. And unlike the Command and General Staff College, the Command and General Staff School as it was known then, which was very strict about adhering to school solutions to tactical problems, there was one right way. On basically the first day of each course, he said, if you have an idea that is better than existing infantry doctrine, let us know, and we will start teaching it. Or as one of his instructors, Joseph Stilwell, said, we'll accept any screwball idea. Similarly, when Marshall became chief of staff in the Army in 1939, in one of the first weeks when he was in the position, he brought his senior assistants, three men that were known as the Secretariat, who processed all the paperwork and made presentations of issues for decision for him. And this three-man staff included Omar Bradley, included Orlando Ward, who would command the 1st Armored Division in North Africa. And Marshall sits them down and he says, gentlemen, I'm really disappointed with you. And so if you've ever been a subordinate in any profession, military, any civilian job, and your supervisor sits and starts a meeting by telling you, you can imagine the trepidation they said.
Yeah.
And what he then said, I'm disappointed in you because you haven't disagreed with me once. And he genuinely wanted to know their honest opinions. He wanted, until he heard the arguments against what he was going to do, the strongest arguments against what he wanted to do, his thinking wasn't clarified. I think his humility and understanding that he wasn't always right mattered greatly to his ability to, as a commander, as a leader of the army. And I think this also reflected very much on the troops below him. Anthony McCallus, who famous deputy commander of the 101st Airborne, who led the 101st during the Battle of the Bulge and the siege at Bastogne. He relates that when he was on the staff at the War Department under Marshall, that Marshall would actually allow him as a major to come into Marshall's office and debate with a major general points about logistics and points about ordnance if Marshall thought that the subordinate, the the lower ranking officer had a genuine point, that rank didn't matter as much as the quality of the argument, that what they were doing was too important to have blind obeisance to rank. So that sort of attitude taught McAuliffe to speak up and to be assertive in what he thought was right. And so famously, of course, Christmas time, 1944, the Germans have Bastogne, the key road network in the Ardennes forest, surrounded. The German commander demands the 101st surrender. And what does McAuliffe, having learned how to stand up for himself, what does he reply to the German commander? He just simply replied, "Nuts." to the surrender demand. And, that was somewhat Marshall's teaching of them to stand up for yourself, stand up for what you believe in, and allowing to being able to channel and to dissent into a productive form, that mattered as well as the same sort of self-confidence that MacArthur had.
As someone who just recently finished the book, and more importantly, someone who's never served in the military, there was some ambivalence on my part initially, because I'm thinking, you crude SOB. And then as I would finish one chapter after another about each of these commanders, you got the sense that had they not been like you just described, there would be nothing, a commander put in the line of fire, leading men into God knows what, many times a death trap. You need someone who can stand on their own, be able to think for themselves. So challenging the commander, by the time I got done with the book, I thought, I wouldn't want anybody else leading men unless they could do that. I want to take a quick pause, and we're going to bring Ben right back. You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. This is The Public Eye. I'm Al Voney, your host. My guest this week is author Ben Runkel. His new book, Generals in the Making, talking about the great the period from World War I through World War II in the making of some of the greatest military leaders this country has ever known, Marshall, Eisenhower, MacArthur, Patton, and so many more. And Ben, then I switch gears a little bit. I'm sure you probably did this a million times in writing the book or just even in your everyday life. I'm thinking, for the vast majority of the years in this country, our presidents, the leadership in this country, not all presidents. In fact, I think most were not with a military background. Yet, and this has been debated between Congress, the U.S. citizens. Sometimes you hear this on the local level and the national level. Well, how can we have someone put men and women into harm's way if they don't know what the hell it's like to put a backpack on and put a rifle and a helmet on and put themselves in that position? One of the examples in your book, one of the people that you talk about, obviously, is General Eisenhower, who later became President Eisenhower. So let me ask you directly, in your mind, should someone who reaches that pinnacle of U.S. leadership, the president, the commander-in-chief, should they have a military background?
No, and I say that strongly as a former airborne officer and someone who takes great pride in the service and feels an affinity to all my fellow veterans and want to thank them for their service. I think that it's an incredibly important principle in this country that we have civilian control of the military. And I think that that doesn't disqualify any former military officer from serving as president, but that it doesn't make it, we don't want to implot the implication that, we have to be a praetorian state, that you have to have been a military officer. I think that we want, as president, whether a Democrat or a Republican, someone of good judgment, and someone of, as again, with Marshall, in the case of Marshall, someone with the humility to be able to listen and learn in the position as well. So I think that's more important than actual military service itself. FDR was a very good wartime commander,
right?
An excellent wartime commander without any direct service. He had been an assistant secretary of the Navy,
right?
But he had very good judgment and was willing to listen, especially to Marshall, about how to properly build the military. Now, one funny thing, that his service as assistant of the Navy slightly skewed his perspective, so that he consistently referred to the Navy as we and the Army as they. Yeah. Marshall finally at one point had to say, sir, stop calling the Navy we, stop calling...
Yeah, I remember that.
I don't think it's a prerequisite. I think okay. that the skills that are learned and honed as a military officer can be very helpful.
Right.
But I think that men of good judgment or women of good judgment can fill the role as well without having necessarily had military service.
Yeah, I mean, for so long I've heard that debate on both sides. You know, maybe it's you know, it's obviously up for political fodder, no matter where. You know, where you go. I mean, it's just one another issue to either negate someone's stance or candidacy or you know, promote it. But I'm glad you said that, especially being a military guy. In the final few moments we have, I mean, I always do this. Some people say, why do you do this? I just can't help it. I mean, you talked about Marshall, Eisenhower, Patton, MacArthur, and so many more. I mean, even if they didn't rise to be the supreme commander, many other men that you mentioned in the book, rising to the level of 3-4-star generals, served major roles in many of the battles, especially during World War II. But let me ask you, because you you got to know these people, at least through your research, on a very intimate level. If any one of them were here today, who would you be most likely to gravitate toward and serve under? Was there one leader that really stuck out for you?
Well, the one who came to, I think all the generals, even the ones who I'm most critical of in the book, I'm at times critical of MacArthur and Patton, for example. I think they all had admirable traits, and I think they all made invaluable contributions to defeating the Axis powers. The one that I would, I think, gravitate to the most, there are two different ways to answer the question. On a personal level, Dwight Eisenhower was easily the most likable of them, mm-hmm. the one that you would want to have a drink with, the one that you'd want to have, you know, as your poker buddy, and obviously an excellent leader. But I think the one that I came to respect the most was George Marshall, perhaps because he was so much unlike me personally, I think, that his self-discipline was extraordinary. He held his subordinates to high standards, but he also gave them the freedom, freedom to solve problems for themselves.
Right.
He led by example and applied the standards of others to himself. For example, in 1940, when he recognizes the rigors of the war to come, he's going to need lead younger commanders, younger generals than what he had seen in World War I. So they impose a fairly strict age limit on who can be high end of service. And because he was going to exceed that level himself, he twice sent his letter of resignation to FDR, because he said, if I'm going to apply those standards to other generals, and he kicked out of the Army some good friends of his, that he had to apply it to himself. And FDR just laughed at him. FDR just couldn't take it seriously that anyone would quit such a senior position. But this exemplifies that Marshall was selfless, both yeah. in his, he was always eager to mentor younger officers. Bradley called him the most influential officer on his career. He mentored Mark Clark. He mentored Matthew Ridgway, but from having known them in the 30s, and was crucial to their development as leaders. But he also, unlike MacArthur, Marshall released his staff to go and serve, to pursue their own glory or to pursue their own opportunities to fulfill their capabilities. So he released men like Omar Bradley, like Joseph Lawton Collins, from his staff so that they could get command positions. And another thing about Marshall, again, is that he exhibited tremendous moral courage. Twice he was willing to put his career on the line for what he believed in.
Right.
Once famously in World War I, where he, as a young major, as an unknown major, basically directly challenged the 4-star commander of the American Expeditionary Forces, John J. Pershing. And basically he put his hands on Pershing, who didn't like to be touched, and said, sir, you are wrong, and here is why. And Pershing respected him for that, and because he needed someone around him who he knew would tell him the truth, to tell him the unvarnished facts of a situation, brought Marshall onto his staff. Similarly, when Marshall was deputy chief of staff in 1938, he directly contradicted FDR in an Oval Office meeting when FDR was proposing a plan to build 50,000 planes, but without providing for pilots, without providing for logistics or basing for it, and where everybody else in the White House was the Secretary of War, the Secretary of Navy, they were all rather obsequious and saying, yes, sir, great idea, great plan. FDR turns to Marshall and he says, George, don't you think so? And Marshall didn't like to be called by his first name because it made it seem like they were intimate friends.
Right.
And he directly said, with all of the president's advisors, he said, no, sir, I disagree strongly. FDR immediately ends the meeting. Everybody filters out and says, well, nice knowing you, George. Say, pack your bags, you're out of D.C. But again, FDR, and this is to FDR's credit, respected that Marshall would tell him the truth, even when it was an unpopular truth, and that led to his selection as chief of staff over other very qualified generals.
I'm glad that that you pointed out that is to this day one of the most important virtues of any leader, is being able to be your own person and put your own neck on the line, so to speak. Ben, if people want to get more information about your work, the book, is there a website? Is there a way of reaching you directly?
Yes. So I have the easiest website to reach me at is makinggeneralsbook.blogspot.com. So makinggeneralsbook.blogspot.com. And I can be reached also at ben.gitmbook@gmail.com. So that's ben.gitm, as in generals in the making, book@gmail.com.
I always tell people, go out and buy the book, Generals in the Making, widely available now. A great read. I mean, especially if you're, and you don't have to be, I can tell you because I've done it, you don't have to be a military person or have a military background. This is U.S. history at its finest, talking about a level of leadership that was most needed at a time when this country, World War II, World War I, World War II, needed leadership, great leadership, men who were able to, step up to the plate, as they say, that cliche, and get the job done, and every one of them did. Again, my guest has been the author, Ben Runkel. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700, or just go to our safe and secure website, wicn.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona.